This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Radio. Andrew Luck was the number one draft pick in the National Football League last year. He was hired to replace one of his heroes, Peyton Manning, as quarterback of the Indianapolis Colts. The hype about Luck was enormous, and many doubted that the Stanford graduate could live up to it. But Luck delivered, setting a new NFL record for the most passing yards by any rookie. Luck also led his team to 11 victories and a spot in the playoffs. This was a team that won just two games the year before Luck arrived. Andrew Luck, a self-described nerd, is nothing if not level-headed when he talks about the transitions from high school to college to pro football.
There are definitely large differences along the way, but I also know a lot of the challenges are the same. So I think fresh on my mind still, you know, finishing a rookie year, you know, what was similar about rookie year to being a sophomore in high school and starting on varsity, you know, once to being in college and starting as a sophomore as well. I think, you know, the same things present itself. How as a young kid, you know, how as a 15-year-old kid do you play with 18-year-olds? How as a 19-year-old kid do you play with 22-year-olds?
Is that what you did?
And yeah, and how was it?
It's
weird, you know. You want to me.
What do you remember about high school ball?
I just wanted to keep my mouth shut.
You were in Houston.
In Houston, which they do have like a somewhat of a religious cult following, you know, of high school football in Texas.
It is Friday Night Lights there.
It truly is, and you know, it's sensationalized a bit with the movies and the books. But people get into it. I mean, we had 15,000 people watching games, you know, for a bunch of high school kids. Yeah, but I do remember, you know, being a rookie, thinking back to, you know, being a sophomore. Like, how do you earn the respect of the guys older than you? You know, how do you go in there and
so would you confidence. Say that's a theme each step of the way if you was proving yourself to people who, when you show up, the vets are there or the guys who have a few more seasons under their belt and you want to show them you belong there?
No, absolutely. I think
describe what it was like when you went from Houston to Stanford.
Same thing. You know, one, it was fun for me to be out in California.
And you were a scholar. You did very well in school.
I did all right. I managed to get by. I studied architecture, which was fun for me, and which I enjoyed, which, you know, I'm much better, I think, on projects than writing papers. You know, I'm glad I studied something I enjoyed, but
do you think that kind of pursuit academically, like something that involves geometry and math and so forth and measurements, helped you as a quarterback?
I don't know. People have asked me to compare the two, and it can't hurt. But realistically, how much could solving a math problem help in a football game?
It might be just intrinsic how you just see things. You know, when that guy's going deep over the middle, maybe you're sitting there going, "This looks like the Louvre to me." And then when you went to Stanford, what was that like? You showed up there. When you talk about that idea of showing up and proving yourself, what was it like for you?
It was great. You know, a lot of great people at Stanford. Everybody has got such an amazing story. You know, you're meeting princes and princesses of royal families from the Middle East. You know, you've got classmates that are inventing, you know, apps and doing all these great engineering
things.
It's a
prominent environment there.
Yeah, it is. And it really, they cultivate an environment of creating great things and people, I think. And so I think, you know, as a football team, we wanted to be up there as well in the athletic world.
But you showed up there your freshman year. And what was your first year like?
First year was great. Didn't play, redshirted, which was difficult.
Describe for people exactly how redshirting works.
Yeah, so redshirting is a process where, you know, you go to school and everybody has 4 years of eligibility to play.
Right.
But you can redshirt a year, which doesn't take away your eligibility in one of those years, but you still practice with the team. You still do everything with the team. You're just not allowed to play in a game. So it's theoretically you can redshirt
buys you another year.
Yeah, and then you go to school for, you know, be in school for 5 years. So it gives you a year to.
And you redshirted your first year?
I redshirted my first year.
Why?
I wasn't ready to play. Right. And I needed to get bigger, faster, stronger, you know, physically wise, and also mentally just catch up to the.
So when
to
you
the game.
Come to a school like that, when they take you there, mm-hmm. and they recruited you, correct?
Yes, they did.
And when they recruit you to come, they recruit you. The redshirt thing was something they had in mind. So at that level, at the Stanford level, they have you come and they say, "We're going to bring you here, and we're just going to develop you for the first year."
Yeah, and some guys in my class were good enough to play, you know, as freshmen. But I know in my recruiting process that was a thought that came up.
They wanted you to muscle up and get stronger.
Yeah, and mentally too. I think mentally catch up to a playbook, having to learn that, and you know, the game is faster in college than it is in high school. So it definitely helped, and I enjoyed it.
I know, what was that experience like? Because someone said that to me once. They said that, you know, you go from high school and you're a dominant player in high school, then you go to college and you're in a room full of high school dominant players.
Yeah, it's
was it really kind of awe-inspiring to you to see that everybody was faster and stronger?
It's humbling. It's humbling. I'll say that. You get knocked off your high horse very, very quickly.
True.
Everybody's an all-star. You go from being in the top dogs, probably starting on every
you're the king back
every,
home.
Yeah, and everything you've ever played in, the cheerleaders want to date you. You know, everybody. You go to college and you're just a
now you're carrying just another, somebody you're else's bags.
Exactly.
So you redshirt that year, and then you come back the second year, and I'm assuming you were stronger and you had developed, and you felt better. You felt stronger.
No, I think I put on like 20, 25 pounds. You know, and my mind was working much quicker when it, you know, on the football side of things.
You were getting ready.
Getting ready,
and what happens in that second year?
Coach Harbaugh, who's coaching the game, Jim, he gave me a shot. Managed to roll with it. Got to play in all the games. I got hurt in the last game of the season and missed out on our bowl game. We had a great running back that year, Toby Gerhart, who's backing Adrian Peterson up in Minnesota right now.
Did you get smacked around a lot? I mean, you're playing football at Stanford. What was that like for you? That threat every day. And is it pure adrenaline where you say to yourself, I can't think about that. I can't afford to think about that. Or every minute you're out there, do you think, these guys, man, they really, if they hit me, it's really going to hurt like hell.
No, I think you can't let yourself think about getting hit. You have to. I think as soon as you start getting skittish about being hit, then your play is going to plummet.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of pride involved in it, too, I think, as a football player. At least in my mind, I sort of enjoy getting hit every now and then and being able to stand back up and say, okay, you hit me, whatever, man. You know, I'm getting back up.
You didn't knock me down, Ray, as they say in Raging Bull. You didn't get me down, Ray.
So I think for a lot of players, there's a bit of that.
What did Harbaugh give you as a coach? What would you say distinguished him as a coach?
I think, he builds great relationships with players, everybody on the staff, and he's an unbelievable motivator, you know. And I think he does it, and he feels guys, he senses what's going to motivate them. And I think he does a great job of using different ways to motivate different guys. On game day, you always felt like, you know, the guy was going to, you know, run through hell and back with you if you had to. You felt like he had your back.
You trusted him.
If you wanted to be in a brawl in an alley, you wanted Coach Harbaugh with you. He was very
now, when you went into the pros, because I'm going to come back to when you finished Stanford in a minute, but when you were in the pros, Pagano was very sick.
Yeah.
And that was a big thing in the NFL. That's a big story this year. You know, what was that like for you with you when you found out your coach was seriously ill?
Yeah, it was a little bit of an unprecedented situation. I think when Coach Pagano went down in week three, maybe.
Had you seen it coming?
No, no clue.
So everybody kept it quiet.
Yeah,
everybody didn't know.
No, we didn't know. We played a game. We had a bye weekend or an early week, so you know we were off for the weekend. We came back, you know, expecting to see Coach Pagano there. Find out. You know, there's a doctor from IU Health and our offensive coordinator who called the plays, sent up there telling us, you know, Coach Pagano's sick, you know, seriously sick, you know, with leukemia, and we'll see how it goes. And it was an odd, it was tough too, you know, tough. But we were lucky; we had a lot of good coaches rally us. We managed to win a couple games, you know, when he was out. And I know as players, we felt like, you know, if we can just win this game, maybe it'll give Coach Pagano something to be happy about this.
So there was there is.
I think, and we didn't say that at the time because I don't think we wanted to admit
you
that
didn't
much
want it to
pressure.
Become Brian Song.
Exactly. I don't think we wanted to sensationalize. I don't want to make it something it's not. But
well, speaking of sensationalizing, so you get to finish out Stanford. What's it like when you leave Stanford? Because you redshirted your first year, then played four, and you finished at Stanford.
Yeah, I played.
You didn't leave
3 years, so I graduated. I had 1 year of eligibility left,
and,
but
And you did, and it was time to go.
It was time to
How
go.
How did you know it was time to go?
You know, my degree. I'd got my degree.
Exactly. Which really didn't make any sense to stay.
Yeah, it didn't. I had enough fun.
And then what happened?
To grow up. And then
tell me where you're sitting when you find out what's going on for you NFL wise. How does that develop?
Yeah, it's actually sort of a long process. And I was drafted before I graduated school. So you finish your college season. We were on the quarter system at Stanford, so I took the winter quarter off to go train and prepare. They have a combine.
Where?
In Indianapolis, which, you know, it was funny enough, was where I ended up.
The Manning Passing Academy.
That's not the Manning Passing Academy. That's a camp in Louisiana, in Thibodeau. But the combine is a really interesting, weird sort of dynamic where they fly all these players in. They have all the coaches. They have all the team doctors. And it's 3 days of,
and
like,
you're their pick.
And
were you picked by them?
No. This is before. So this is a chance for all the teams to meet the players to see.
So the combine is NFL wide. It's not just Indy. It's league wide.
It's league. All the teams fly into Indy with all their personnel. They all stay, and then the players sort of cycle through. We're like cattle in a meat market.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, walking up on stage with nothing but my little skimpies on.
Yeah.
And they announce, you know,
it's the Victoria's Secret runway show.
Yeah, exactly. You're on a stage with strength coaches, head coaches, you know, all these coaches sitting in bleachers around you. That you walk up in the middle, and they say, you know, Andrew Luck, Stanford University, you know, 6'4", 235.
And guys are there with pads going, I don't like the ratio of his thigh muscles to his rib cage. Write that down, Ray. I don't like that rib-thigh ratio.
God knows what they're saying up there.
God knows.
Yeah, and then you turn around and you walk off.
Yeah.
That's just one of the, you know, guys where you're getting 100 x-rays on every part of your body. They move your knee this way, your toe that way.
So you're like an astronaut.
Way. They have all your medical records, you know. They're going back to, hey, you know, it says here in 2006, I was 16 years old, 2006, you know, bro, you sprained your right ankle. It's like, how did you find that out?
You stole that candy bar from the drugstore next to the movie theater when you were 14. We got that down here, too.
They do. I swear.
You got a lot of private detectives working for the NFL.
They do. But which makes sense because there's so much money invested by these teams and the
modern
players.
World, yeah. So anyway, so you're there and you take your clothes off and except for your underwear, they size you up. You turn around, you leave. What happens next at the combine?
Then you go do a bunch of physical, you know, running a 40, throwing
tests.
A bunch of physical tests. You know, a bunch of psychological tests, IQ tests. You know, mental health tests.
What's the quiz they give you now? The test?
Oh, what's it called? The Wunderlic.
The Wunderlic.
The Wunderlic. Do that
because it's presumed that the playbooks now are so complicated they need people that can literally.
It is.
Put that together.
But I think
some put it together better than others.
Some do. And then you know, some take stock in the Wunderlic, some don't. You know, right. I think different teams have different ways of evaluating guys. So that was an interesting experience. Then you leave the combine. And I had a fairly good sense that I would be drafted number one by Indianapolis just from the signals I was getting from the team and other things. And managed to, you know, and then school started again for me. So I leave, you go, and going back to school and flying and, you know, visiting teams and draft happens in New York, which is a pretty neat experience.
Describe what happened for you.
I remember walking out on stage and some people applauding and some people booing.
Why?
I don't know. You just, NFL fans boo.
How did you feel? I mean, you knew it was going to happen, kind of. It was, everybody let you know that in advance. Everybody, the cat's out of the bag. But when it happens, the moment it happens, did you just feel great? You were number one in the draft that year, man.
Yeah, I felt on top of the world.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie. A little nervous. I didn't want to trip walking out on stage to shake or hug the commissioner. He's into these hugs when you walk on stage.
He's glad you're there. He's going to make a lot of money off you.
Yeah. So that was fun. I remember having a little pin that my mom was trying to, you know, the little pin that she was trying to pin on my suit, and she was really nervous because it took about 2 minutes to get, you know, the little pin goes, hey, let me go.
Yeah.
Mom,
how did your dad feel? Your dad was a high school quarterback. He played for West Virginia. He played for the Oilers.
Yeah.
How did he feel to see you do this? That's a great thing for a dad who's a scholar athlete as well.
Yeah.
to see his son do that. What did he say to you?
I think he was very proud. He just said congratulations. I don't remember specifics, but yeah. he didn't talk
good
much.
Day.
He just kept smiling.
Yeah. You knew. He felt good.
He did. And we have a great relationship. It's easier for me having a dad who played in the NFL and did a lot of the similar.
He had a couple seasons where he played, and then he backed up Warren Moon for quite a while.
Yeah, he did back up Warren. He also backed up Archie Manning his rookie year, so we have sort of a connection with the Manning family.
Now, as soon as the draft is over, I would assume there's a euphoria, but you snap right out of it because it's down to business now.
Yeah, there was a euphoria, and then I wish it would have been down to business. I had to go back to school and finish up, and you try sitting in a lecture. You know, after you've been drafted by a team, you have a job. You know where you're going.
I honestly don't feel sorry for you because I can't think of anything I'd like more than to go back to Stanford, having been the number one draft in the NFL. So you go back. How long are you back there?
Back for maybe a couple more months
to finish that last quarter. What time of year is that? The draft is when?
The draft is like April,
right? And so you got to go back. What was it, the summer quarter?
It was the spring quarter, and we finished up in mid June. So
you were in the quarter, and you went to the draft and came back.
Yeah.
So in the midst
of
the quarter,
it's
draft, come back, and then you finish, and you're done with Stanford. You get your degree.
Yeah.
In architecture.
Got it. Yeah. Somehow they let me. They let me pass.
You were good for Stanford. And so now, when do you report?
So we report. Late July was when training camp starts, when, you know, the actual...
That's the formal training
camp. The formal training
camp. So you show up for your first pro training camp. Now you are in the center ring. It ain't high school. It ain't college. It ain't Big Ten. It's professional football. Yeah. What's that like? I mean, does your ass tighten just a little bit when you're there?
I puckered up a bit.
Yeah.
I puckered up a bit.
These guys are huge.
They are. They are the apex of physical freaks. You know, there are some guys that are 300 pounds that are running faster, you know, running
than your high school running back.
Yeah, that are just absolutely physical. And you know, some of the guys you walk in the locker room, you're playing with 35 year olds, 36 year olds with three kids and a house and a bunch of rookies who are 22, 23 years old that you know don't know right from left.
Yeah.
So it's a different dynamic than college where you're sort of.
Well, everybody's
fraternizing with your buddies. You're going back to the dorm. You know, you're hanging out. In the NFL, it's different, which makes it fun when you win and come together as a team, you know, because you really do have so many different types of guys.
And I would imagine that your teammates, I mean, on one hand, people in the pro, like if you go to college, it's assumed under ordinary circumstances, certainly things can change, but under ordinary circumstances, you're going to be there for the 4 years.
Yeah.
This is your team. This
mm-hmm.
is your family.
Yeah.
But in the pros, where people move on, where the teams have their loyalty to the players only extends so far, do you walk in there and people feel you out and you earn your way into that family? Or do they treat you like family and everybody cohes right away?
No, it doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen in the first day. I will say the guys—
People got to get to know you?
Yeah, you got to get, you know, I think you have personalities come out and you know, see what meshes, but— especially during training camp where you're going to have, 100 guys that are in training camp. And then one day you wake up and look and there's only 53 guys left.
Yeah.
You know?
Just under half are gone.
Yeah, half are gone. And then that's when
there's a tension there.
There is a little bit. But once the final cuts are made, which is those cut days are very sad days because you see buddies go. You see guys you've built relationships, you know, go.
Guys you admired maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. Guys you looked up to. Guys that helped you out, you know, when you first walked in the door.
And then they're gone, and that 53 players, that's when everything starts to cohes?
Yeah, I think that's when you come together a little more. But still, you know, even guys are traded in the middle of the season. You know, guys are cut still. Guys are picked up. So it's a lot different, you know, to what you said. Than you're going to be in college for 4 years. You know who's in your class. You know who's, you know the guys on the team.
A lot of familiarity.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, one thing I think about when I think about the NFL is this idea of the biggest, strongest, fastest men hitting each other in this very violent game.
Yeah.
And the rules have been changed in order to protect players. The equipment has evolved. Obviously, there's a lot of discussion about concussions and so forth over a lot of brain injury research and issues and people donating the brains of their deceased suicide victims, a lot of heavy-duty stuff.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you, when you go out there, I mean, it's a competitive game and people want to win, but at the same time, guys don't necessarily want to hurt each other the way they wouldn't want to get hurt either. Do you find it's a weird balance of those two? Because football is as violent now on one hand as it was before,
But because equipment changes and rule changes, it seemed more violent back then.
Yeah. You know, I don't think guys are any less aggressive when it comes to hitting. It doesn't look
that way.
No, it doesn't. And I think, you know, maybe there's a thought, too, that all these equipment changes and you feel safer in it, so you feel like you can hit harder. But there's also, I think, you know, guys are being taught, especially at a young age now, too, you know, how to tackle correctly to save your
knee.
Neck. Yeah, how to and I think there is a mutual respect between players where, you know, you're not going to try and take out someone's Achilles or ACL, you know. But some guys maybe do. I don't know. Some guys play very aggressive, and things happen. We understand. You know, we know what we sign up for. I think when you play football, and I like it and I love it. And as a quarterback, you know, I'm 99.99% on the wrong side of the hit. You know, I don't ever get to dish it out per se. But you know, that's fine with me.
Right. Let's talk about quarterbacking.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what it's like to have that job where I played touch football with my friends until I was 40 years old. We played every weekend during a season in the fall in New York, in Central Park, and then that game moved to Los Angeles because almost all those guys I played with were my colleagues in the entertainment business. And, of course, the difference between a sandlot game, the difference between a flag game and a bunch of geezers playing football, the difference between high school and college is the speed and the velocity of the game. And you drop back to pass, and on average, how much time do you have to throw the ball?
I think a little between 3 and 4 seconds.
So you have that much time?
If
the play is going—
In a perfect world.
So you have 3 to 4 seconds
to
read the defense.
Mm-hmm.
You know from the pass play, and you are this architecture student. We're not going to let you off the hook there.
No.
You know the trapezoids out there, who's going where.
Yes.
And you have a couple of seconds to drop back and ascertain who you're going to throw the ball to, who's open, who's more likely going to be open. Because sometimes you're throwing the ball to someone anticipating they're going to be open once the ball gets there. Yeah. You throw the ball to a spot very often.
Very often.
Unless it's a broken play and they come back to you. It's a comeback and then someone's improvising.
Yes.
What percentage of plays would you say do you throw the ball at a spot that's a preordained route, and how many plays is it more improvised? What's the ratio?
Well, every play is called, you know, hopefully not to have to improvise. Right. You know, you're going to call. But
then
I'd say
up against a pro defense.
It breaks down probably, you know, a third of the time.
Who drove you nuts this season in defensive backfield? What team drove you insane?
Ed Reed on the Baltimore Ravens.
The Ravens.
Yeah, because, you know, there's a you're taught there's a structure to defense. You know, if one guy's blitzing, that someone else should be covering his spot. If you're playing, you know, cover three guys divided.
There's
the field
a consequence
of a third,
for everything they do.
Yeah, then you should have, you know, a corner on the right, a safety in the middle of the field, and another corner on the left. Ed Reed, you know, he's everywhere. He's down on the box. He's on the line of scrimmage. He's running. He's responsible for the middle zone, and he's all the way over. And
he's a warlock.
Yeah, he's a renegade. But he does it, I think, because he understands football so well and studies the offense. You know, he says, okay, I know when they're in this formation, there's these
and that's
five.
An innate skill people have. That's just a God-given skill they have.
I think it is, but I also think he works at it and watches film and knows, you know, and studies and has played for so long.
I want to ask you. How much do you think that people, it's innate? Like when you watch football, you see people do things that other people don't do. You see magic happen. When you watch, I mean, I'm going to date myself, obviously, because I'm talking about guys from you know, the glory days of when I was watching NFL, you know, constantly. I got a lot of, you know, a little less time to watch every Sunday now, but I catch a game every weekend or the highlights. But like if you watch Sanders and you watch someone move the way Sanders moves, you say, nobody does that. When you watch Namath, what made Namath Namath, in spite of all of his notoriety, you never saw somebody throw the ball on the dead run to their receiver. Maynard never had to break stride.
Yeah.
And that ball would hit him in the tips of his fingers on the dead run, and he would take it into the end zone, which a lot of guys have to come back to the ball or whatever, or they got to jump up and do the ballet move for the ball. You see people, and it's work, but do you look at them sometimes and say, it's just God-given, it's genetic with some of these people?
Yeah,
they just have gifts, the mental as well as physical.
Yes, I think you do. And at least once a week, it seems like you're watching film and you stop and say, how did that person do that? You know, there's no hope for me in this league. These guys, you know.
Who are QBs you grew up admiring?
Peyton Manning.
Peyton.
Love Peyton. Still a big fan of Peyton.
Sure.
Steve McNair, you know, who's since passed away. But he was a tough guy who could sling the ball all over the field. So those two guys.
What do you admire most about Peyton? You had the tough job, obviously, of replacing Peyton.
Yeah, no, I always admired how Peyton commanded everything.
Never quit.
Never quit and was like a general out there.
Got 3 minutes left, we're down by 18 points, so what?
Yeah, so he was fun to watch. And he seemed like he knew where everybody was going all the time. Yeah, there was no surprises for him. It was like everything was so well rehearsed that it happened. And whatever the defense put out there, there was no chance.
So you're very young. You're how old now?
23.
Oh my God.
Not supposed to laugh at that.
You're 23. I'm old enough to be your father.
He's only 23, but Andrew Luck has been working toward this moment for more than a decade. In a minute, we'll hear about what kind of football Luck prefers and the strength training he thinks is most important.
I think your core and your ass is where so much power.
You can't shoot a cannon out of a canoe, they say.
Where so much power is generated.
This is Alec Baldwin. You're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Radio. Growing up, Andrew Luck went to school in Europe. His father, a former quarterback himself, led the World League of American Football, the NFL's experiment with starting a league abroad. When his father changed jobs and the family landed in Houston, Andrew was ready to play ball himself. At age 14, Andrew attended the Manning Passing Academy in Louisiana.
So, you know, the Manning family, obviously sort of the first family of quarterbacks,
of course,
you know, in this league. So I was in eighth grade in Houston, and I went to the camp as a camper.
And it's held in Louisiana.
It's in Louisiana. It used to be Hammond, Louisiana, was where I went as a camper. And you stayed in these dorms. It looked like Soviet era, old gray, no AC. Yeah.
In the summertime?
Yeah, in the summertime. Oh, it was hot.
So summer in Louisiana, and you're in the eighth grade.
Yeah, in the grade, living in these cinder blocks.
It was one of the early tests of your
doors.
Character.
Yeah, exactly. But we had a blast. You know, I think I was on cloud nine when Archie Manning came up and said, "How you doing, son? I played with your dad." And I'm like, I'm in heaven.
Oh my God.
Shoot me now. I've lived. Then you go to college, whatever, and they invite all these college quarterbacks to come down and be counselors. And I think it's a great thing. It's a great way to meet, 30 other quarterbacks around the NCAA and get to know them. So I went down my last 2 years of college and, got to know the Manning family, obviously, a little better through that, and a bunch of quarterbacks from college. So
Was Kaepernick at that camp?
Kaepernick was at that camp. I got to know Colin there a little bit. A lot of guys, and it's fun. It really is fun, and it's a unique opportunity because it's not often you're around your peers in a relaxed setting like that.
When you want to work on your passing skills, and by that I don't mean the timing and reading offenses, the mechanics of you throwing.
Yeah.
What's your primary set of exercises and work you do? Did you have a coach? When you got to the pros, did they come in, as they often do, and dissect your throwing motion and get into the whole mechanics of your throwing again?
Not in the pros.
They didn't.
I think there's a thought that if you've made it this far, don't change your throwing motion.
They've done it millions of times. So it's not like Tebow where they're coming to you.
No.
I mean, you're not Tebow, but I'm saying people have the assumption that in the pros, they want to strip you down and say, okay, let's start all over again.
Yeah.
They didn't feel they needed to reteach you how to throw the football.
No, absolutely not. Right. Which I'm very thankful for because I don't think I would have handled it very well.
I think
quarterbacks are very particular about their own motion and a little bit anal.
Sure.
This is the way I throw the ball. This is the way it's because
what muscles do you think you had to develop? And if you wanted to improve when you were younger, when you added 25 pounds, when you wanted to muscle up and strengthen up,
because
I said to Joe Montana once, I was doing a film and Montana came to visit the director on the set.
Cool.
And I had the quickest, most fleeting conversation. It wasn't very real. I said to him, I go, what was your strength training? He said, I avoided weights as much as possible. I didn't want to get muscled up. He said, I took medical tubing.
Yeah.
Like hose, and I put a strap in a doorway, and I just did the throwing motion over and over, like 1,000 times with this tension thing just to strengthen the rotator.
Shoulder cuff, yeah.
What exercises do you think you have to strengthen your legs and your back as much as your upper body to throw football?
I think your core in your ass is yeah. where so
you
much power.
You can't shoot a cannon out of a canoe. They say.
Where so much power is generated, and I think that's
so a lot of leg training.
A lot of leg training. A lot of
weight
core
training or run training.
I hate running, right. But you have to do it. But I think it's more weight and just rotation. It's almost like golfers. You know, you're very
one, and boxing.
In boxing, you're very one-sided.
It's almost like throwing a right cross. You know what I mean? Because you throw that punch, you got to rotate that hip into the punch.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And you become very one-sided. You're always torquing in the same direction. So making sure
to your left.
Yeah. So you're making sure you're evening out. You know, your right side of the body,
right.
Per se. But I and that's something that I learned more, you know, of in college and in the leagues. You know, how important your lower body is to throwing.
I would play in sandlot pickup games with my friends. And, of course, when you play for fun with guys when you're, you know, when I'm in my 30s and 40s, just for fun, half the guys bring their own favorite ball. And the ball is deflated or inflated to the level they prefer. The ball is scuffed to the level they prefer.
Yes.
And when you pick up a ball in the NFL, forget about weather conditions. Is the ball always a crisp, waxy, brand new ball? Or do they allow you to treat the ball the way you want to for your preference?
I hate the crisp, waxy ball out of the box.
I can't
stand it. There's our equipment managers for the Colts, Frog, T, and Danny. The three great guys that work with their quarterbacks, they have a top secret protocol
to treat the
balls. It's secret. They won't tell me. I don't think they told Peyton when he left.
I know what it is, by the way. I'm going to tell you.
Please.
It's they pee on it. It's their own urine. They use their own urine to strip the waxy film off.
Who was the baseball player that used to pee on his hands to avoid calluses? Right? It was a Cubs player. But I know. I've seen
that. So they have a patented top secret. It's like the formula for Coca-Cola, and then the football's treated. But you do treat the ball.
You do.
And it's not out of the box.
It's not out of the box. And I've seen different stages of it. Like I know they put the balls in the sauna for like a couple minutes.
They're allowed to do that.
Something about that.
The league allows them to treat the ball.
They do. They do.
And does every team get to use their own ball? Like when you come out on offense, we go get the box. We go open the crate of your opponent's balls. Everyone brings their own ball on the field as long as it's the approved ball.
Yes. And from what I understand, it used to not be that way. It used to be like there was a certain, you know, all the balls for game day were open an hour before and each team used the same ball. But I think Peyton and Tom Brady sort of, this was before my time, I was
sure,
coalition against that and got it changed where teams can use, you know.
What about the inflation level of the ball? Does the ball have to be inflated to a certain poundage?
I think it does. And referees check it and they mark the balls off before
the balls have to be approved in one way, but you're allowed to treat the exterior of the ball.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So when you're there and you're throwing the ball, is it completely unconscious? Or when you throw the ball and you think you're ineffective, do you sometimes say to yourself, even at the pro level, that you got to go back to a basic that you got to remember? You're bringing the ball in behind your ear. What are you going to do? What's the firing sequence in your mind of throwing a pass?
Yeah, I think you don't want to think about
you
it.
Don't,
you don't. And that's – well, I shouldn't say ever. When you if you're going on a string and balls are dying on you and you're saying, why –
What if you're having a shitty day and you're not throwing the ball well?
Yeah, I think that's when you maybe not during the day, but afterwards.
How do you hit the refresh button?
Yeah, you look at the film and you say, what am I doing different than what I did?
And do you see sometimes you did?
Yeah, I think
so. What did you do differently?
I think, you're dropping the ball too low. And it's elongating your whole windup. You know, it's almost like a pitcher now instead of a quarterback, you know, instead of throwing a football. And that's what's causing you to be late on all your routes. You know, make sure, so that we can practice, you're going to work on keeping that ball, you know, higher and maybe shortening that motion. So I think you still tweak it every now and then if it's not working out, if you feel like it, you know, it's inhibiting you from doing, you know, from being better.
For fans like myself, when we watch you play pro football and you're doing your job and you're just humming that ball out there, you're hitting that ball, first downs, whatever, and the other guy drops the ball. Does he come back and apologize to you?
Every now and then. Different guys are different.
Right.
I probably apologize too much for throwing interceptions to the guys on the line because I know they get fed up when they're blocking their butts off against some werewolf of a defensive end, and they're doing a great job. And, their quarterback throws an interception. Good job, QB. But, you know, some guys apologize, some guys don't. It's just the nature of the game that we're humans, you know. Human errors occur.
Let's talk about the season, and I'll talk about it, the season beginning, actually, when the season ends. So your season ended.
Yeah.
And you guys did not go to the Super Bowl.
Yes.
And you were eliminated from playing in the Super Bowl. How?
We were eliminated in the first round of the playoffs by the Ravens. which is no fun. And you don't prepare for, you know, the end of the season. Because you're in the playoff, you want to go to the Super Bowl.
Sure. So you think there's more to go.
Yeah. So you show up Monday. And
you got a few more blank pages on your schedule.
Yeah, you do. Really do. And you show up Monday, and it's guys are cleaning their lockers out.
It's very similar to the film business, too.
Trash bags. You're saying, well, you know, all right, see you, man. Maybe you're back next year. Maybe you're not.
Maybe
you know, you don't know. So it's odd. And then I remember sitting around for a couple days saying, you know, all right, I got to get out of town. I got to, you know, I can't sit around in my apartment and leave. So I went to Sundance Film Festival.
How was that?
It was awesome.
Yeah.
It was a nice way to
ski?
No, I can't ski contractually.
Okay.
That's a no-no.
Yeah, no motorcycles.
No, but had a great time there and a nice way to sort of get away. It's not the crowd that recognizes football players too much. So it was a nice way to get away, which now I'm blowing my cover, I'm sure. Yeah. For next year.
Yeah, be careful out here.
But hopefully next year we're in the Super Bowl. I'll travel a little bit overseas somewhere.
I was going to say, do you still have a bug for Europe having grown up over there?
I do. I think I have a...
You lived in London too, right?
I lived in London, Frankfurt, Dusseldorf, some suburbs outside Frankfurt.
When you go over there, what do you like to do?
I see the sights like any other tourist. I think I'm going to go back and look at all, you know,
is what you're trying to say? Do you have a girlfriend over there? Is that what you're trying to say?
No, the girlfriend's coming with me
over
there.
I understand. So it's a couple gondolas with your girlfriend. We get it. We understand what you're saying. A
couple drinks here and there.
It's very romantic over there. I get the picture. Do a little shopping.
Yeah, but no shopping. I can't stand shopping.
For your girlfriend, I mean.
She'll go, maybe. Yeah. Maybe.
Andrew Luck has other things on his mind besides shopping. He wants to relearn German in the off-season, and of course, he's hoping to bring a championship back to Indianapolis.
Still young. Hopefully got some time, and it gives you a little motivation for next season.
So there's a part of you that really is looking forward to getting back.
Yeah, there is, that'll continue to grow as the off-season goes along.
After a few more gondola trips with that girlfriend of yours.
They'll be sick of each other and ready to go work out again.
This is Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing comes from WNYC Radio.